My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document.
When his aircraft began to nosedive into the Black Sea, he was unaware of the journey it would take him. We talk trauma, injury, recovery, and the power of sport. An Endeavour Fund special, Nathan Jones. This is Declassified. Ninth of Feb, 2014. You're having a cup of tea at the back of a flight, just like we're having now. Cup of tea with your mate, back of a flight, and you literally hit the ceiling. And I want you to take it from that point.
I mean, I don't fancy hitting the ceiling in here, but I didn't really fancy hitting the ceiling in the jet. But it happened, and it was a bit of a shock. So we were on a routine flight from Bryce Norton to Camp Bastion in Afghanistan. When halfway through the flight, you know, you're looking at a 8.5 hour, 9 hour flight where you're going to be landing in the dark just for safety reasons, and it's the lowest point of or lowest target, really. So it's the lowest risk time of day to go in. So it just gone dark, and I was the co-pilot of this Voyager aircraft, the A330, and I got a tap on the back, and it was a mate of mine that was going out there. And so I said, "Oh, give me a second, I'll come out and have a cup of tea with you, just like we're having now." And so we did our checks, and I went out into the front galley. So it's just like you going on holiday. It's just a kitchen at the front of front of the plane. And a amount of time later, we were just mid-conversation. Suddenly, myself, my friend, and everyone else that wasn't strapped in was stuck against the roof. And then it was panic stations. It's kind of fight or flight moment. Mm-hmm. And I had to crawl along the roof.
Just before we get to that point, literally just having a chat with your mate a couple of minutes in. Yeah. And this is standard. You can do this stuff as a co-pilot. Like you can go for a leg stretch.
Yeah. So when you're on a long flight, I mean, even if you're on a short flight, you can get out of your seat and go for a walk around for a leg stretch. Mm. It's controlled rest. You know, you could have a sleep in your seat if the other pilot's in control.
Yeah.
You can go for a bathroom break, but no, it's encouraged to have a break, so you keep alert.
And you're with him at the back. How far away from the?
Probably about 5 meters.
All right, Kirsten.
I'd say so. You've got a bulkhead wall, and an armored door, So if you're on an airliner, that door's shut. So it's an armored door with a code on it. Because we're on a military flight and everyone on board is military or UN or press, but you've gone through that screening process, you can fly with that door open. It's actually changed since this incident, but at the time...
Unlocked or open?
Open, right. Wide open, yeah. And latched, which, thank God it was, because there's no way I'd have been able to suddenly dial a code in and then get down and open this door. So it meant that my route was on the roof to then go down probably a foot to get through the sill of the door, and then back onto the roof of the cockpit, and then climbing down over all the circuit breakers and buttons and everything on the roof over to my side.
So the aircraft takes a nosedive.
Yeah.
When you're having this, like again, this, go back to this cup of tea. What
I didn't angle? Finish the cup of tea as well. I mean, that was all over me.
What a bastard. What angle? What dictates a nosedive? Because I think it's quite important. Like, it's not mellow, is it? It's pretty.
No. So what had happened was a camera had got stuck in the controls of the between the side stick. So it was flying an Airbus. So rather than a control column between your legs on an Airbus, it's a side stick. So just like a control column or a joystick on a computer, it's like that over to the side of you, and then you've got a big ergonomic armrest. And what had happened is somehow a digital SLR camera had got jammed in between the side stick and the armrest, and then seat moves forwards, lodges it, seat moves forwards again, and it sticks the side stick fully forwards. So it's like someone's stuck their foot on the controls and sticks you into a nosedive.
And there's absolute chaos going on.
So luckily, about 15 minutes before this, I think it was about 15 minutes, we had a bit of turbulence, so I put the seatbelt sign on.
Okay.
So most people had gone back to their seats, strapped in, and fallen asleep. The people that hadn't, because when, you know, seatbelt sign went back off again, the people that were awake then got up and were chatting with friends and doing whatever. So they were all up and about down the back. So those guys and girls then were stuck on the roof in various different positions, whether that was in the middle where, you know, the ceiling's pretty low, or in the aisles where the ceiling's pretty high, and they'd smashed through the coving panels of the jet, and they were then stuck on the roof, as in the metal skin of the jet, and then came down stuck on the hat racks and the overhead compartments when the jet came out of the dive. They smashed through all of the emergency exit signs, which are made of glass for some reason, so they all smashed all over the floor. It was a mess down the back, but I didn't actually see any of that because those guys were stuck in the back,
yeah,
and my route was route one.
Can you remember forwards. Crawling through like
yeah.
now?
Yeah.
So you were in a 45 degree?
I don't want to say it and get it wrong because it will be in all of the flight data monitoring that's open source now online, but I think it went into about 15 degrees nose down, and then because it's these new automated laws on an Airbus, it limits how the aircraft goes down. So it limited the pitch down, which is amazing, because if it hadn't, we'd be dead, because it would have just carried on pushing down vertically down, the wings ripped off, and then we'd have just gone into the sea like a tube. So Airbus saved us there. The Airbus limits the speed that you're going, which is incredible. Mm. So you've got your overspeed protections on it. And then once it's got to a point, it then starts pulling gradually out of a dive. Like, these Airbuses are so clever. And it's all of these different fail-safe mechanisms that are built into the flying laws.
Let's not take anything away from what you did, though. You climbed back into the cockpit.
Yeah.
Got hold of the controls.
Yeah. And then, it was, I suppose it was a combination of fiddling around with controls, both pilots. But in the end, we recovered this jet. My feet were still on the roof. So then it pulled out of the dive whilst I was sort of upside down. And then I then concertinaed into my chair like a banana, but sort of the wrong way. So I was doing a pretty killer yoga move. And then the jet actually went into this PIO, they call it. It's a personally induced oscillation. So it means that the jet's going all over the place, really. Because we're trying to wrestle with the controls and get it back, get the speed under control, get it back straight and level, and get it. I mean, you've got to picture it now. You've got one pilot who doesn't know what's happened, and he's got his anti-G strap on, and he's sort of pinned up and trying to figure out what the hell has put this plane into a dive. I've been mid cup of tea and then suddenly smash into the roof. And then when I in the galley, it's there, bright light like it is in the studio, probably bright actually. And then you go into the cockpit and it's pitch black. All there are is just flashing lights from various controls or buttons. All of our body armor, weapons, books, bags, everything, maps, all stuck on the roof. And then all I can see is black, as in we're going into the sea. And then that is a case of things are happening. They say things go in slow motion, but they really did. And it felt like this was a bit of a lifetime to get from where I was in the galley up and in, and then my little tootling journey across the roof. And in fact, it was like under 10 seconds. It was really quick.
Oh, right.
Like flashed a bang really quick. And then to get the aircraft back into sort of straight and level, it was not long at all, but that amount of time was obviously enough time for chaos to...
Was y'all screaming down the back. Pandemonium, was it? Was people
was
going crazy?
It was mad down the back, yeah. Yeah, you could hear it. So we wear headsets, much like the ones that you've got here, these big Bose things. So normally, they're powered noise-cancelling things and you can't hear anything. Because the jets that we fly, they've got all of these different kit on the outsides of them with different defensive aid mechanisms. Mm. So it's spoiled the airflow over it. So rather than it being a nice quiet aircraft, it makes it a lot noisier. So we have to fly with these headsets on. That headset where I rested on the sides, there's a little handle by the side of my seat. So the headset had gone. So when I got back into my seat, I was there having to shout across which then added to the confusion of what was happening. So we're shouting, going, "What the hell's happened there? I don't know." With worse language than that. I just remember the noise was horrendous getting back in, because the jet was going so fast, all of the different bleeps and alarms were going off, and it's the rushing air. I just remember it was so noisy. And then listening back, I mean, I've listened to the cockpit voice recorder so many times now for different interviews, and it is horrible listening to it. I tell you what, I'm lucky that I didn't see what it was like down the back, really, yeah. Because then when we finally got this, we put the autopilot back in, and it was, you know, it was a fully functioning jet then, because not that we knew, because we didn't know what had happened to it.
Yeah, okay.
So we were just in this state of constant alertness, like teetering on to panic. We fly with two engineers, so ground engineers for when we land, they'll then, yep, service the aircraft. And we were going into Afghanistan, so they were going to be with us on the ground, so we had them in the cockpit trying to diagnose what had happened. So they're flying through manuals in a state of shock themselves. Mm. And they were just saying, we've then got a purser down the back, so just like on a normal civilian flight. And he was hilarious, using pretty choice language with what the situation was like down the back. But after all this had happened, they did an amazing job and got the back squared away, and got what's it called? Like the black and yellow hazard tape, and were taping all of the ceiling panels that had come off onto the back of chairs and moving people around so that they were a bit more comfortable. Because there were 198 people on board. So I think I've read stats and been told stats that if we had have gone in, it would have been the biggest single event of loss of life since the Second World War. Because that's a lot of people to go at once. So
what would have happened if you'd have been... Was you injured?
Yeah, so...
Initially?
So the... Well, I had no idea. So I was... When I hit the roof and then getting in through the door, I'd split the back of my head open, cut all my hands and my arms, and because we're flying into the desert, we're there wearing desert flying suits, which is sort of a khaki colour flying suit. So I'm there covered in blood, and then all the controls are there covered in blood. And it was, do you know what? It wasn't that painful. It was more annoying than anything that I'm there trying to hold a control stick and then make selections on buttons, but with squelchy blood. Mm. So the engineers, instead of they're filing through manuals, I was like, can you just get me some of the blue roll to wipe all of this blood up? Because it was so annoying. Mm. And it was... You know, if you've been in an impact, say you're in a rugby game or in anything, fall off your bike, whatever, and you've been in that impact, it doesn't really hurt. It's just a bit of you feel like you tensed up, but it's all the adrenaline, because the adrenaline levels were ridiculous in there from trying to figure out what the hell had happened, to then landing and then the relief of having those wheels on the ground. So it didn't really compute.
So what would have happened then if that head injury had have gone, you know, one step further and you'd have knocked you out, or worse, what would have happened to that flight? Would the pilot have been capable of pulling it back?
I'm sure he would have done. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would have hoped so. I'd have hoped so.
Mm.
Yeah. 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 Eventually, it would. You know.
How far did it dropped?
I think it dropped about 6,000 feet. It was something like that.
In seconds?
How
long?
Oh, we were going down quick. We were going down at 25,000 feet a second. Oh, 25,000 feet a minute.
So a minute and a half and you'd have been done?
Yeah. So we were over the Black
Less
Sea.
Than a minute and
so
half.
There you go, that's sea level. But then over to the right of us, where sort of 3,500 metre mountains. It's that northern mountain range in Turkey. So if we'd have just been over to the right, then we'd have gone in a lot quicker.
What you were talking about then, the kind of avionics engineer or whatever going through the manuals, and that is standard practice. That's why those manuals are there, that you get them out so you don't make a mistake. There's a difference between that and then what you guys did, and we've heard it time and time again, whether it's, you know, a magazine pouch checking when you before you move or this kind of stuff. Was it instant, like, I'm in a mode now where I've got to get back to that seat, I've got to get... And everything just takes over.
It was, yeah. Because that's the thing, when you'll have been in these situations yourself, you haven't got time to assimilate information or to process anything. It's just that instant, I've got to do it, I've got to go. You know, it's like if a bang goes off, then some people dive on the floor, some people run towards it, some people run away, and you don't know how you're going to react to that. And when I was on the roof, I just remember kicking off the wall. So it was where the computer is that the purser uses, and it's... all the in-flight entertainment bits. Mm. And I just remember kicking off the wall there to get me across the roof. It was a weird, weird situation of weightlessness, but stuck on the roof. Mm. And then, so yeah, we did the rest of the flight, landed. I just remember chatting to a guy, because clearly you've got a lot of panicked people down the back, and a lot of which are pilots going into theatre to take over from squadron mates. And it would have been worse for them than it was for me, because, you know, they're qualified pilots and they're stuck in the back and sort of completely helpless. At least I could get back in.
You're
and
busy, weren't you?
Do something.
Busy.
Yeah. So if your mind's busy.
How long left with in the flight?
Oh, it was an hour. I think it was close to an hour before we landed.
Did you land in Bastion?
No. We landed in Incirlik. So that is in Adana, so southern Turkey. So it's in that armpit of Turkey just before you get to
Syria.
Is that
because you thought there was a problem with the aircraft? Not the camera getting struck?
Yeah, it was.
Well,
we had no idea what had happened.
Yeah.
So it was a case of the fear of the unknown. I don't know what's happened here. So mayday call and get it on the ground. Problem is, I'd been out of the flight deck for, I think it was about 15 minutes for this break. I think it was 18 minutes they said that it was. Having a conversation and a cup of tea. So when I get in this disorientated position, it's like you've suddenly got to switch on and know where you are. Mm. And I didn't know where we were.
Right.
So it was a case of, where are we? And we're there trying to bring up maps and figure out where we are. And the airfields, on a normal route, you kind of know, right, you've got an international airport there, you've got an international airport there. It's really fairly straightforward, just where we were in the middle of the Black Sea. You've got Russia out to the left, Georgia in front of you, and Turkey to the right, and huge hills all around you. And we're in a big A330 jet, so you can't suddenly turn on a sixpence and stick it into a little strip. So, I mean, hey, they can dissect what we did afterwards and say that we should have stuck it somewhere else. But we'd both the captain and I had been into Incirlik loads of times before.
So it's an American base. Right, okay.
Yeah.
So you get in there then, land it. What's that? Relief? What's the feeling? What's your feeling like?
I mean, there was a big round of applause at the back.
Yeah. Was it sarcastic or was it like...
one of the guys came up to me and he was like, do you know what? I've never been in turbulence like that. And I was like... Yeah, cheers,
okay,
mate.
Yeah.
No, neither have I. people coming up and hugging you and... we were there for a week. We were in Incirlik for a week because they sent all of the engineers out to pull the jet to bits to figure out what had caused
it. Who comes out? The French from Toulouse, or is it all military?
No, it wasn't the French. We might have done, actually. We had representatives from Airbus. We had the Military Aviation Authority, the Civil Aviation Authority. We had Air Tanker, who the military have the contract with for the voyages. We had Air Force representatives. There was loads of people continuously flying over.
Did you have to stay in Turkey then for a period
of time?
So
I was there for a week, yeah.
Was it?
Yeah. I mean, you wouldn't have got the guys on another plane to fly back.
Oh, everyone was there. 200 people
everyone
were there.
Everyone was there. And some people wouldn't get on an aircraft to fly back, so they had to road move back from Turkey to the UK. I mean, it was a pretty terrifying situation. And the next day, because when we landed and they were trying to sort things out on the ground, because it's a diverting aircraft on a mayday, so you know you turn up and all the fire engines are there and the blue lights are going, which, you know, then we're there taxiing in and I'm saying, look, ladies and gents, just don't worry about this is just a formality, because they'll then go into panic mode again, thinking, are we on fire?
Yeah, when you see blue lights going on.
You know, that is just, it's one of those things. it's just the welcome for British Air.
This water arch is normal. Yeah. Don't worry about that.
Yeah, it's de-icing.
Yeah,
we're in Turkey. Yeah. So I just said, look, let's everyone get off the aircraft. Take your essentials and leave everything else on here. We'll just come back on tomorrow and get it. The next day, some people wouldn't get back on the aircraft, and it's on all of its wheels on the pan. It was that traumatic for some people.
What was you feeling like with it?
Do you know what? It was a weird, weird state of elation for getting down. So I was on a bit of a high. Mm. I mean, we got really drunk that night. Mm. And just the fear of, the feeling of what happened there. But do you know what? And now I've been through all the interviews and everything afterwards, and it's been going for years of, you know, why did you not do this? Why did you not do that? Why were you not talking about how this was caused? But we were having so many different interviews and speaking to different, the TRIM teams. So for the trauma and risk incident management, checking that you were psychologically all there, and the medics going to the hospital over in Insulet they wouldn't really see us because they were on the American system, so they just sort of went, there's a load of painkillers, you've got a knackered back, and it's because for me it was my back and neck that were really stiff. And I was thinking,
like a whiplash, or
it was like a whiplash. It's just like I've been in a bad tackle, I'm not going to say car crash. It's as in,
but a bad tackle where you get your head
bump,
rang.
You know. So you were feeling ropey, So they just gave me some strong painkillers that I wouldn't be able to fly on, but it would make you feel good. It was one of those things that we didn't really sit down and talk about. We had pockets of people going off and doing their own thing, and people crying, people sort of, you could tell that they weren't there, there in body but not in mind. And even the people that came out, I felt were a bit unsure of what to do, because it's just an emergency situation, isn't it? And the fear of the unknown. Mm. And it was a really weird week.
Yeah.
Really weird week.
What did you meet your mate again? Did you see your mate?
Yeah, no, I went and saw him. Finished that cup of tea.
Did you? What did he say about it?
Same sort of thing, really, that he was terrified. And I remember him, because I remember him hitting the roof with me, because we were, you know, it was like the two of us talking now, to then suddenly slamming into the roof, and he went back and I went forwards. And I have, because this is the thing, I have sort of different visions of what happened when I've spoken about it so many times. Been over and over it, and then you hear different things. Like you hear the voice recorders, you hear different people's versions, and then your version then gets blurred. Really,
it's perspective as well.
It's other people's perspective and how they saw it. But I remember in dreams that he said something like, when we were on the roof, I better get back to my seat or something like that.
Really?
Yeah. And I was thinking, I mean, that is some situational awareness.
It's very British as well.
On the roof.
Well, the seatbelt warning signs have come up. I must get there.
I better get back to my seat.
Mate, you come back to the UK then after that?
So yeah, we came back to the UK. I was in this sort of,
it was a state of denial, really. I had, I don't know whether it was the, they said it could have been to do with the impact, but I had problems with my eyes, so I couldn't really see anything. So I went home, and I was kind of stuck at home in Wales for a week or so, because I couldn't drive. So then the investigation teams were there in this flap trying to get hold of me, trying to figure out what had happened, because they grounded every A330 in the world when
in the
this
world.
Happened.
Commercial as well?
Commercial as well.
Did they?
Only for a certain point. Then Airbus then cleared civilian A330s to fly after X amount of time. And then, but the military Voyagers were grounded for 10 days to 2 weeks. So people were stuck all over the world.
Yeah, did that affect like R&R and all that, I'm assuming?
So. Oh, of hundreds and hundreds of people. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we wouldn't have been flavour of the month. So...
You were to 200 people, though.
Yeah, to 200 people, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's interesting now, chatting to people, and they were like, oh, that was you doing that. Oh, I was stuck in Afghan waiting to come home. Cheers. So, yeah, it was kind of a weird situation coming back to the UK, and then, do you know what? It was probably... In the long run, it was a stupid thing to do, but it was the only way that I could personally deal with it and refocus. And it was all about getting back on the horse and getting back into the cockpit as quickly as I could. Mm. So I would go to the medics and it was just like, yeah, I'm fine, nothing wrong with me. When clearly there was, but it was if I was out of the cockpit for a long period of time or any sort of extended period of time, the feelings of fear, doubt, would have just manifested themselves that it would have been really hard to get back in. Because at this stage, we still didn't even know what had happened or what had caused it. So then the squadron were deploying down to, or setting up a detachment down in the Falklands, and I volunteered for that. So I just wanted to get away from it. So
fly over. Did you fly him over? Or was you just...
Oh, I was a passenger in the back. And then, but I was flying in the Falklands.
Yeah, yeah.
So I got cleared to fly by the doctors.
What was it like being sat in the back? All right. Or...
No, it was horrible. It really was horrible being a passenger then. And every little bump or rumble, it was on edge. And I'd be grabbing my seat. And it was, yeah, it was hard. And I still get it now a little bit. When certain things happened, but I mean, I'm well used to it now. But yeah, it was, and I just sort of got instantly back into it and just brushed everything to the side, taking loads of painkillers to numb the pain, and my back was just getting worse and worse and worse. And then, but I was just in this weird denial state where I wanted to crack on with it, and I've always led such an active life. Mm. It was like, well, no, I'm fine. I just grizz it and man up.
Because you was a pro rugby player before you joined up, so you played for Leicester Tigers before.
Yeah.
Then after this, you did the Falklands. Then you went and did skiing. Is that...
Yeah. So I'd just come back from skiing when this incident happened. So the inter-services skiing is on now in Maribel as we talk. So it's always the first week of February. So the week before this happened, I was skiing in Maribel. We won the inter-services. And then we came back. I stayed at the officer's mess at Bryce Norton so I could get a good night's sleep. And then we flew out and did this flight. And then this incident happened.
Mm.
Then... A year later, I'd you know, been grizzing along, seeing the physio, getting straight up, just getting strapped up, taking all these painkillers and just thinking, oh, you know, I should be all right. I should be fine. Skied again, ended up winning the RAF champs, winning the inter-services, and my back was in tatters now. And I was like, there must be something wrong. The physios were like, you just need to get a scan. So got scanned, and they were like, you've broken your back.
Mm.
So I'd been...
You'd broken your back.
I'd been meddling around for a year, and the disc between my L5 and S1 had prolapsed so much, it crushed all the nerves, and then you could see in my S1 of how the vertebra had crushed.
Where is that?
So it's all lower back. It's all, so...
What was that from?
So L is the
was that from the impact,
spine.
Or was that from when you went, you pulled out of it? How did it happen? Do they know?
So the consultant
is that a compression injury or is it trauma injury?
The way that the back had, so spine and disc, he reckons that it was partially done when I hit the roof and partially done when I went into the seat,
right,
the wrong way. So this is what the consultant was like looking through all my notes, and we went over and over the story, and that's how he was trying to decipher how I did it. I mean, this is years ago now, isn't it? It's five years tomorrow.
Yeah.
So very timely in doing this.
Yeah. What was recovery like? So you broke your back.
So I went
your
straight
eyes
into
that all right now. Your eyes and your head. Was that?
Oh God, yeah. I mean,
that's
they,
all
they,
done.
Yeah.
A year after, that's all cleared.
All fine. Yeah.
So it's
yeah.
Just
that
the,
was
it's just
so it's just my back.
In
just
the colours of the back.
Yeah. Because I was getting all of the nerve pains down my the back of my legs, yeah. And the doctors were just like, oh, it's just sciatica. And what had actually happened, and why, you know, because I left it for a year being stupid. The disc prolapsed, died, and calcified because it's got no blood supply in it. So calcified, so it just becomes like a bit of bone.
Mm.
So when the surgeon had to go in,
is that three discs then together, or is
no,
that just
one?
The ones, but there's no movement. There's nothing.
No movement. So he had to, so rather than a disc has got the same sort of consistency as like a bike inner tube. So you can just, if you're going to take it out, you just slice it and take it out. This, he had to get a hammer and chisel and smash the whole thing out. Because of that, before I went in for the op, he was like, we've got all these risks, sign for those that you're happy. The one thing I don't want is a spinal fluid leak, because then, you know, we can have complications. I wake up from this operation, can't feel my legs, and he goes, so we've had a spinal fluid leak. That's like great, but I mean that was fine. That was by the by. It didn't sort of manifest itself in any way. But he said, do you know what? That was the most complicated and most difficult spinal fusion or spinal surgery that I've done.
Hmm.
Just with how
military doctor or is it a civilian doctor?
No, civilian doctor.
Where was it?
Civilian surgeon. The Great Western Hospital in Swindon. Mm. He's amazing. He's done all my surgeries.
How many you had?
Three. So after that, my back got an infection in it, which then they panicked because it's in your spine, it can go out to your brain. So they quickly went in and did a clean up op, and then in May this year. So May last year, had my spine fused. So I've got all the titanium cage in there now and bone grafts.
What?
So that's my final one. That's it. That's me done.
No,
done.
The what or how firstly did Invictus play, or what did Invictus play in your recovery? Because you're still serving now.
So still serving now. Still flight attendant in the Air Force.
But
yeah.
Invictus did have a role to play.
It had such a profound effect on my recovery because. At this point, I'd been, you know, it's hard to say because you had the initial incident and then it was a year later that, so I kind of start my recovery journey from, that's it, first operation. And then, so that's 2015, I had that. And then it's now 2019, so that's a long recovery pathway, really. Mm. Even though I got back flying in between. But the... recovery for anyone, it's incredible in the military because you've got all these recovery centres and, you know, it's all the state of the art equipment, the consultants that are dealing with you are all the best at their game. going to spending all this time at Headley Court, where, you know, everything is, they're not leaving a stone unturned. It's the best of the best, and they're used to it by now, with the Iraq and Afghan conflicts going on for so long and having so many different complex injuries in there. You know, these guys were all over it. So even that happening, it's still a long road to recovery, and it's still pretty mentally and physically draining. And I was months and months and months into it, and my doctor consultant, who was actually at RAF Holton at the time, I was just in a consultation with her, and she was the doctor of the first Invictus Games in 2014, and she was like, why don't you go for the Invictus Games? So you're prime candidate for that. And she had the website up, and I was like, what sports can I actually do? Because I'm not allowed to run now. Mm. And so since I had my first op, they've said, no, you can't run.
Still now,
yeah. And so I was like, well, would I be able to go on a bike? She said, well, we can test it in the gym. Fine. So we did the tests on that. You can swim. Okay. Yeah, we'll do that. So that was it. I applied for cycling and swimming, and then got put on one of the training programs where they set you up with the coaches, and you go to these different training camps. Then went for the trials for the Orlando Games, which was 2016. In, I can't remember what time of year it was. I think it was the spring. And then made the team. So that was it. And my recovery then sort of switched from loads of really mundane but focused rehab, where you're just trying to get better. So I was trying to get better to get back flying. Then it was you're on a training program, full-time training program, to then get you to the best shape possible to be competing at an international sports event. So it was a real change of your rehab, but change of your mental state, and it gave you this unbelievable sense of purpose again, which I thought that I'd lost and that I would never get back. So that profound effect that it had on me, I think you can see in people's eyes when you're at these events, whether it's training events or just meeting them at a launch or going to, and when you're competing with them, you can see these people that you're competing with or against have really got this sense of purpose again. Some people might have been professional athletes in the past, even in that sport that they're competing in now, or they've never competed in sport before or in that sport before. You get all every
and then
every different
some
variable.
Serving, some not serving.
So the vast majority are veterans.
Really?
There are I was still serving in it, but I think in the Orlando Games I was the only serving Air Force. There were quite a few serving Army, but you know, the majority are, if they were serving, they were kind of on their way out or in that recovery process.
This is part of it.
It's all part of it.
This was part of that recovery.
It's linked into this recovery pathway, which is an amazing thing. It's an amazing thing. So you've got two different types of people. So you've got the people in their recovery pathway who are still, they're still in the middle of that journey back to recovery. And then you've got these people who might have thought that they'd, that all was lost because they've been medically discharged from the military, from the thing that they love, the thing that they know. And then it suddenly gives them that purpose. And something to train for. So I remember watching the first Invictus Games when I was on debt in Afghan, because I got back flying, like I said, after this incident in 2014. And then I was there and watched it on BFBS TV in the...
When was the first one? 14?
2014 in London.
14, yeah. Yeah,
of course it was. At the Olympic Stadium.
Yeah.
Which was amazing. And
But you weren't injured at this time.
I wasn't injured. So
you got your back, but you were.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was watching, going, God, I hope I'm not never one of these guys.
Yeah.
And then the next year, or no, it was 2 years' time. Yeah.
2016. You captained the swim team
in Toronto. Yeah. So I've done two Invictus Games now. So I did the Orlando one, and then did Toronto. Yeah, 2016. Then I had my last operation, and then if it's possible, I was too injured to compete in the Invictus Games. But for me, that's kind of my Invictus journey done, so that I've drawn a line under the competing of it now. And it kind of leads us nicely into how the Invictus journey is going for those older and bolder athletes. And through the Endeavour Fund, which is what we'll go on to in a bit, I'm hoping, or I'm in the process of doing coaching qualifications, mentoring, and going back in. So it's all about giving back to what this movement has.
Let's jump into the Endeavour Fund now. Briefly overview, because there is this same, but different. There's a clear distinction between Invictus and the Endeavour Fund. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the Endeavour Fund is essentially what finances and shines the spotlight and does a lot of the work for things, projects like the Invictus Games. Is that right?
Yeah, so the Endeavour Fund was set up from when Prince Harry was first serving in Afghanistan. So he was out there, and then the press got hold of it, so it was too dangerous for him to maintain an operations. So he was flown home as quickly as they could. So I think it was Lord Dannett who was
that's right, yeah, yeah.
Who was CDS at the time, and he ordered Prince Harry to come home. Well, obviously, asked him nicely. So Prince Harry flew home on a C-17 on one of the flying hospitals. So the routine trips, or not routine, but they became routine, going into Queen Elizabeth Hospital in Birmingham. Mm. So it was Selly Oak at the time, and the experience that he had in the back of that C-17 aircraft with people who were fighting for their lives, missing limbs, and with body caskets in the back, I think it had, well, I know it had such a profound effect on him that he felt that he had to do something about it. Mm. So off the back of that and what he'd experienced in Afghanistan, he then set up the Endeavour Fund. So the Endeavour Fund is there to, it was originally there to help fund and facilitate these amazing adventurous and sporting endeavours for wounded, so people that have been wounded in combat situations in the military. So that was walk to the North Pole, walk to the South Pole, climb Everest, row the Atlantic, all of these headline amazing achievements, and the Endeavour Fund enabled them to do that through funding.
Was it the bigger kind of events initially then?
Like, yeah,
that's what you just said.
Yeah.
There's...
So it's this, we've through the Endeavour Fund, there's been this phased approach. So phase one, which was just the Endeavour Fund at the start, and it was purely that. It was these individuals or teams of guys who wanted this a sense of purpose again. So which is why this led on to the Invictus Games. So it was, as I said, the headline endeavours for these guys to achieve some amazing goals after they'd been injured. And they were, each one was climbing their own Everest, really. Prince Harry then went over to the States, and the Americans, as you know, they've got their Warrior Games, which is the purely Americans doing it. I think other nations now go and take part in it, but it's their wounded servicemen and women multi-sport games. He saw it, real profound effect
on him, and he thought, do you know what, we're going to have to do this, but on a bigger scale, where it's a World Games, which is then the brainchild of the Invictus Games. So then they set themselves this aggressive timeline to try and put this on, and wanted it in the Olympic Stadium and all those facilities in London after the 2012 Olympics. So they set about doing this through the Endeavour Fund, and they put on the inaugural games in London in 2014, thinking that, you know, this could just be a one-off, not that it was going to continue year on year. And then after that, then other countries saw how amazing it was, and they've bid for the games, which is why 2016 was the States bid for it, so had it in Orlando, and then it was a Canadian centenary, so they bid for it and got it in 2017, and then 2018 it was the Australian centenary, so they got it now. They're having a year gap, so it's in The Hague in 2020. But this summer is the UK trials. They're making a big thing about it in Sheffield. So it'll be 500 UK athletes competing in an Invictus style multi-sport games.
Also, there is a mini games. So is it open like to the public?
Yeah. So, but it's expanding on that. It's and looking at veterans employment, veterans in the arts, getting school kids involved. It's a really, really nice, nice event. But it's over a week. You know, it's a big thing with an opening and closing ceremony. And it's acting as the trials. So it's the UK trials for The Hague. So rather than being in Bath over a weekend, it's now going to be an actual week long
and a real nice
champs
kind of stopgap really in between the Invictus
games
and
the having Hague,
that.
Yeah.
And but you know, you said it then. So phase one was all about that initial, let's just do something. Phase two now. Well, this is going into phase.
Well, so
on,
well,
it?
Phase two was then.
Is this phase two of the Endeavour Fund?
This is phase two of the Endeavour Fund.
Yeah.
Yeah. So off the back of the Endeavour Fund starting this out, starting the Invictus Games, the Invictus Foundation was formed, and then so the Invictus Foundation then runs the whole of the Invictus movement.
Is that like standalone now then?
Standalone, and then that is then supported by the MOD. Help for Heroes. So the MOD run the military side of things. Help for Heroes run the UK team, and Royal British Legion run the support for the families and friends.
Okay. So a real collaboration.
Yeah. So they collaborate alongside all of the key sponsors to put on the Invictus Games, and then they work with the host nation. The Endeavour Fund still supports the Invictus Games, but it's got so big that it's its own entity now. So the Endeavour Fund then went from this phase one, where it was just giving money to these individuals, to getting these individuals to give back. So it was to set up an endeavour. So it's to set up an actual program that that then has an impact on more Wounded Injured and Sick, so the WIS community. And it was looking at trying to get the hard to reach. So it was people that had never taken part in these sports or adventures before. It was trying to get the severely injured that didn't think that they could compete in anything. Well, it's not competing, it's just taking part in something.
Yep.
And giving them something to work for, a purpose. And we've got some amazing endeavours now. So we're just coming to the end of this phase two now. So we've got endeavours like Depth Therapy, which is a scuba diving endeavour where they take the WIS community over to Sharm el-Sheikh in the Red Sea and take them for a week's diving.
Off the back of that, then they have these pro-social activities where these guys are trailblazing in what they're doing. It's exactly what we want. And they do marine cleanups, so reef cleaning, beach clean. You know, they're not doing this as a throwaway thing, just trying to do a bit of good. It's an actual, they're trying to make a difference.
Just with that purpose behind it, we had James Cameron in from Mission Motorsport.
Yeah, from Mission Motorsport, yeah.
So he was in, I think it was episode 17, I think.
Yeah.
And didn't really go into it that much, but he was really focusing on the fact that it isn't the motorsport.
No.
It's not the motorsport.
Yeah.
Whereas others have got, in my opinion, and those, I think they've got that wrong, and it's about the thing.
Yes.
It's not about the thing. It's about that long-term recovery. Can we get the purpose? Can we get meaning back? Can we get long-term employment, stability for families, well-being, wellness, all those things that create, I suppose, happiness, really, and fulfilment.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you've hit the nail on the head, and James is doing a really... I mean, he's doing an amazing job there at Mission Motorsport, and what Mission Motorsport have achieved there with the racing, with getting people qualifications in being a racing driver, mechanics, engineers, all that sort of stuff. And now they're developing an electric car. Ooh. So getting people into the, you know, there's
high voltage stuff.
Yeah, the next level.
So Mission Motorsport, sorry to interrupt, Mission Motorsport are
they're an Endeavour.
An Endeavour.
Yeah.
Off the Endeavour Fund.
So the Endeavour Fund is made up of all of these different endeavours. So then, which is why we've got, Mission Motorsport is the motor racing, Turn to Starboard, so that's getting the Wiz guys sailing in Portsmouth and Folkestone. So that was from an experience on a boat to then doing a zero to hero course from nothing, never been on a boat before, to get your yacht masters all the way through your exams, everything all fully funded. And now they're going into sailing racing. So they're now going in, getting the fully manned, wounded guys on the boats, then racing in cows and all the rest. It's really, really amazing. Really admirable what they're doing, and Sean Pascoe, that's running that, is doing an amazing job. But now we're just announcing. So Prince Harry announced at the Endeavour Fund Awards about Phase 3. So this is us changing the way that we're running it, and it's all looking towards a giving back and extending the reach, the positive effects of what you have achieved and what you've experienced by doing an endeavour. So it's not this go do an endeavour and then enjoy it and then that's all you do. It's go get fully involved, try and have a bit of longevity with that experience, and then give back to others. So that could be get your coaching qualifications, and then you're going to then teach your family members or other families how to do that sport or activity. So then that gives you a sense of purpose back in the home, which you may have lost. It could be going into local sports clubs where you're teaching children with disabilities or children that have come from the wrong side of the tracks and had had issues through their childhood.
Like young offenders or...
Young offenders.
Yeah, people are vulnerable.
Exactly. And then working from that, all you're doing is trying to increase the pro-social aspects of the activities that you're doing, and it just gives the opportunities to not just the Wiz community. So you're using your Your experiences being in the military and your, I suppose, expertise, then it's only going to be a positive outcome.
Well, I think there's so much to give as well. I see it time and time again, and the growth and the post-trauma, post-conflict growth that this generation, especially this generation, is showing. But the lessons that we can learn at this phase three is, it's amazing. It's amazing.
It should be, and we're really looking forward to it. As I said, when you can reclaim your identity as a parent, if you're having that pro-social aspect with the local community, and as I said earlier on, it was something that I want to get into, and I would implore any of the other Invictus athletes to do it. Well, you don't have to be an Invictus athlete, but that's the model that we're going to go on. But getting back involved in the sports that you had been competing in, training in, given that opportunity to compete in, and now you can then give back as a coach, a mentor, an ambassador, however you see yourself best fitted in that, because the Invictus journey, when you stop competing beforehand, the guys and girls will have thought, well, that's kind of drawn a line under that, and that's it for my competitive role really in this, because unless you're going to move on and go to the World Champs, Paralympics, Olympics, which is what a lot of the guys have done, or some of the guys have done, then unless you go into this coaching and mentoring side of things, then it's really that's the end of the road. But now this should give the opportunity to get these guys and girls back involved.
It's good, mate. Really, I mean, and then so that's the future of the Endeavour Fund. It's where we're going with it. That phase three and who. And you've just probably briefly just said it then. Who are the people that this is going to affect most?
So it's not precluding the people that have already done and already experienced the endeavours, because what we're trying to do is get these guys and girls to come back and then do their qualifications and then give back. Mm. But also it's continuing the work that we've done in trying to locate the hard to reach, get them involved in this, and then, because it doesn't have to be you setting up a big football club, say.
Yep.
It could literally be you're going on a rock climbing endeavor. You do 2 days rock climbing and get good enough to then be able to then pass this down to your children. So and then it's getting your kids or your wife or husband into that sport with you, and then it's that scatter snowball effect of actually
what it could do, what sport can do. And I'm just, you know, the summary of what I'm just saying there, you're almost creating that community again, that feel.
Exactly.
Creating those role models and really highlighting that, and mentorship and all the good stuff that we've got in abundance, that community has got in abundance, and it's just bringing it to the forefront.
Exactly. So that's just been launched. We're really excited about it. And I think it's the way that these military charities should go. There's a lot of take, and what we're trying to do is then getting these guys and girls to give back. And when you might not want to initially, but I think the rewards that you get from giving back are far more profound.
We'll leave it there.